The second graduate of faculty in Christian Forum of this year. My name is Gordon Carter. I'm on a committee working with the Forum, and we've been delighted by various speakers over the years who have come from near and far to stimulate us on important topics on the interface between faith and various academic disciplines, the arts, the sciences, the social sciences, law, medicine, etc. And so there's always an element of discussion, somewhat of debate and critique, but I think always there's that sense that we're here to discover together. And a similar form I've just read about is written up in this book. It was published in 2006 called Finding God Beyond Harvard, The Quest for Veritas by Kelly Monroe Kuhlberg. You can have a look at that later. Delightful book on how something like this started at Harvard University and expanded really across North America with discussions at many of the major university campuses, especially the research institutions across North America, to the delight of thousands, literally thousands of people. So we're very excited, part of a great tradition, and we're glad that you're here to celebrate this learning experience with us. Some of you may have to sit on the floor, but you can still learn from that perspective. Because it takes a little bit of humility to seek the truth, I guess, some people say. Anyway, this forum has been going since 1988, so it's in its second decade. And our next speaker, to plant a seed in your mind, is Dr. Dennis Danielson from the English department here at UBC on his recent book on Rheticus, who is the one and only disciple of Copernicus. So it's the title of the lecture is Why Copernicus Matters. And that's on January 23rd, location to be announced. I also have one other book here by Dennis Alexander, who's a professor from Cambridge University, and he will be our speaker in March. So his book, Rebuilding the Matrix, Science and Faith in the 21st Century, is quite a tome on dealing with that whole area. So you can tell we're dealing with a spectrum of topics. But today, without too much further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Paul Williams, who's here from Regent College Graduate School next door as part of the University of British Columbia Matrix here at this end of the campus, at this side of the city. And we're looking forward to a very stimulating and maybe provocative discussion on globalization. Just to give you a bit of background, Paul was appointed the second incumbent of the David J. Brown Chair of Marketplace Theology and Leadership at Regent College in August of 2005. So he's relatively new to this side of the pond, as they say. He's also director and economic advisor to DTZ, or Z if you're American, a multinational real estate consulting and investment banking group headquartered in London, England. Paul trained as an economist at Oxford University and worked in the economic consulting business for several years before doing some theological training here at Regent. He then returned to the marketplace, working as an economic advisor for several organizations, international corporations and government agencies. He worked for the British Labour Party on various aspects of globalization for organizations such as the BBC, Center for Exploitation of Science and Technology, and it goes on. He was appointed expert advisor to the European Commission on Sustainable Development, and prior to joining the full-time faculty at Regent, he was chief economist and head of international research for DTZ. To our delight, his research interests include globalization, capitalism, and sustainable development, the role of religion in social and economic development, social capital and workplace spirituality, participatory economics, and theology of the public square. We wonder when you actually sleep, Paul. We're looking forward to an excellent talk from you on humanizing capital, an anthropological critique of the ideologies of globalization. So let's welcome Professor Williams.
Well, thank you very much, Gord, for that mercifully brief introduction, and it really is a privilege to be with you in this forum. I want to begin with two quotations. The first is from Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments, published in 1759. Man was made for action, and to promote by the exertion of his faculties such changes in the external circumstances, both of himself and others, as may seem most favourable to the happiness of all. And the second is from Thomas Friedman's recent book on globalisation, The World is Flat. The dynamic force in globalisation is the newfound power for individuals to collaborate and compete globally. The phenomenon that is enabling, empowering, and enjoining individuals and small groups to go global so easily and so seamlessly is what I call the flat world platform, the product of a convergence of the personal computer, fiber optic cable, and the rise of workflow software. Individuals from every corner of the flat world are being empowered. Globalization makes it possible for so many more people to plug in and play, and you are going to see every colour of the human rainbow take part. So says Thomas Friedman. Though differing in so many respects and separated by nearly 2.5 centuries, both Smith and Friedman share an optimism about human progress under conditions of freedom that's rooted in Enlightenment idealism. Friedman's optimism, however, alongside that of fellow globalization enthusiasts, is far more dangerous than Smith's, because unlike its 18th century counterpart, capitalism today exists within a moral environment that offers almost no restraint to the behavior of the individual in the pursuit of self-interest. In this lecture, I shall argue that the contemporary diminution of moral restraint is no accident, but is rather a product of capitalism's internal logic, and in particular, its understanding of human nature. This internal capitalist logic, I shall contend, is the main driver of globalization in the modern world, and the root cause of many of the problems associated with it. Globalization critics have thus far failed to attend to the anthropological dimension, and as a result, their solutions are unlikely to succeed in addressing the very real problems that they have identified. First, we must begin, though, with definitions, not least because globalization is what the German linguist Uwe Porskin describes as a plastic word. That is, a word that sounds scientific, but actually blurs meaning and disables common language. Globalization turns up in no end of article, conference, and seminar titles. It's used to describe changes in information technology, global warming, genetics, the growth of air travel, just about everything that seems different since the 1960s. Any number of things appear to be globalizing, a phrase which helpfully means to render global. Now, in addition to the rather vacuous and plastic way in which the word is used, globalization is also a term that is subjected to a lot of ideological scrutiny. According to Gillian Young, in her book, in her work on globalization, feminism, and the information society, globalization is a word that obfuscates power relationships. It is in fact a word which masks rather than reveals present reality, according to Susan George of the Jacques Maritain International Institute. It is convenient shorthand for de facto exclusion. It's a myth. It's a synonym for neoliberalism, or, according to the London-based Globalization Institute, it is a force for good, because only by integrating the poorest into the world economy can we put an end to the poverty that still blights much of the world today. The reason for all this ideological scrutiny is that, in the words of Malcolm Waters, globalization has become the primary idea by which we understand the transition of human society into the third millennium. How then is globalization to be understood? It can be described as the process by which market economies, governments, and cultures are becoming increasingly interlinked and integrated across the globe to an extent that fundamentally undermines territoriality as an organizing principle for social and cultural life. A growing global consciousness then arises with resultant behavior changes. Definitions of globalization differ as to whether economic, political, or socio-cultural causes are given primacy. What I will argue is that whilst all of these concepts and causes are indeed important aspects of globalization, they do in fact arise from an underlying process that is fundamentally economic in nature. The emergence of instantaneous global communications over recent years has certainly accelerated this process, and the structure it provides is logically separable from the spirit of capitalism that birthed it and continues to animate it. Nevertheless, we will not understand globalization's particularities or find solutions to the problems it presents without attending to the underlying logic of global capitalism that is driving it. Relative to this underlying capitalist logic, all other aspects of globalization are what we might call second or third round effects. I should also say at this point that I do not regard capitalism as equivalent to the market economy. Rejection of capitalism as ideology does not, in my view, entail rejection of a market-based structuring of economic life. Let me now trace the underlying processes of integration and interlinking that constitute globalization in its economic, political, and social dimensions. The process of economic integration occurs as capitalism transacts national boundaries, extending transportation and communication infrastructures, expanding markets, enlisting greater tranches of labor power throughout the world. This aspect of globalization is more than the idea that a capitalist form of economic activity simply spreads to more countries. Rather, it relates to the functional integration of local, regional, and national economies at a global scale, so that an increasing proportion of global wealth is produced and distributed within a unitary system of globally connected firms. The geography and organization of the firm becomes essentially global in conception and transcends the geography of nation. This expansion of an increasingly efficient capitalist mode of production is matched by the development of a new kind of global market for consumption. Yongjiang Shi and Mike Gregory describe this in an article on international manufacturing networks. I quote, "This global market is based on the shared and common demands of different countries. It integrates different national preferences into a core entity and presents this as a fundamental and non-differentiable market requirement. To satisfy the growing global market, the traditional products and related development strategies are clearly not enough to satisfy companies' internationalization. Transnational corporations are therefore keen to learn about and develop global or world products and to restructure their worldwide manufacturing systems. In other words, it's in the interest of global firms to improve their own efficiency by selling the same product throughout the world as far as possible, rather than having to bother with different national tastes or preferences. Economic integration then leads increasingly to a globe constituted as a single market for commodities, capital, and labor. The political integration of nation states, as embodied, for example, in organizations like the World Bank, IMF, World Trade Organization, and the European Union, is best understood, I suggest, as a response to the need for transnational political cooperation in the face of widespread economic integration. Government policy becomes increasingly directed toward the international environment. Political decisions which promote foreign investment and liberalization both facilitate globalization and are required by the powerful capitalist logic of economic integration. An efficient, globally integrated manufacturing system, for example, requires access to target countries in order to buy or lease land, import machinery, hire workers, and depending on the industry, sell products. It also requires capital and tax arrangements that facilitate the flow in and out of the country of working capital and profits and the avoidance of double taxation. It is this logic that leads the IMF, for example, to require developing countries to deregulate their markets, allowing unrestricted access to international mobile capital, and to remove any protective barriers to their consumer markets from outside competition. It would be a mistake, though, to think that global markets bring pressure to bear only on small developing countries. Even the wealthiest countries are involved in what has been described by one author as a race to the bottom, as governments attempt to make their societies as attractive as possible to mobile companies. In an attempt to protect themselves from this process, governments may cede regulatory power to international institutions on the grounds that if a large number of states agree to a given standard, then mobile capital cannot play one off against the other. These supranational political policies and practices are now far more than just a link between societies. We're moving from an international system of states toward the global integration of political power. Finally, cultural integration occurs as this economic and political integration leads to a compression of cultural and societal relations arising from the growing interdependence of the different parts of the international system. Cultural symbols or signs that represent facts, preferences, tastes, beliefs, and values are increasingly separated out from their local contexts and shared rapidly within the emerging global village. All of these processes, economic, political, and cultural integration, have been dramatically accelerated by the development of modern information and communications technologies. Virtually instant communication with any part of the globe is now not only possible but routine. Access to global media of all kinds means that there is now a truly global consciousness in a way that's never before been possible. As well as enabling economic, financial, and political integration, this has also encouraged the rise of global consumerism and exposed all cultures to an invasion of foreign ideas, customs, and values. These ideas, customs, and values have been dominated and infused by the compelling logic of capitalism. The capitalist logic that lies at the heart of the process I've described has two main aspects. The first concerns its utilitarian individualism. In neoclassical theory, the human person is modelled as an abstract individual, the locus of rational choice, and the goal of capitalism is to maximise the range of choices available to individuals so that each can optimise individual utility or happiness. The Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor describes the utilitarian self as follows. The aim of utilitarianism was precisely to reject all qualitative distinctions and to construe all human goals as on the same footing, susceptible therefore of common quantification and calculation according to some common currency. This focus on procedural rationality, argues Taylor, is a consequence of rejecting any source external to the individual to serve as a basis for morality, a rejection itself arising from the Enlightenment notion of freedom as individual autonomy. So whilst a moral good, namely happiness, is recognised, Taylor argues, quote, this is characterised by a polemical refusal of any qualitative discrimination. There is no more higher or lower, all that belongs to the old metaphysical views. There is just desire, and the only standard that remains is the maximization of its fulfillment. End quote. Capitalism then offers the individual the prospect of freedom from the constraints of tradition in order to maximize individual happiness. In this way, capitalism harnesses an ideology of progress and consumerism that offers the prospect of happiness through material wealth and liberation from social constraint. Happiness, or utility, can be measured monetarily, in that each individual's choice reveals a preference and consequently an expression of their pursuit of happiness. In any transaction, an individual is thus revealing a value of one thing in terms of another. The price system allocates a monetary value to this transaction, and the sum total of all transactions thus represents the total utility in an economy. The goal then simply becomes the maximization of this total utility, or in modern parlance, the pursuit of economic growth, measured in terms of gross national product. The fundamentally mistaken utilitarian anthropology that underlies this vision is not only false, but dangerous. Referring to Kantian critiques of utilitarian self, Charles Taylor notes that, quote, instrumental rational control of the world in the service of our desires and needs can just degenerate into organized egoism, a capitulation before the demands of our lower nature. Contrary to Christian, and indeed many other religious and philosophical understandings of the self, the rational utility maximizer of capitalism knows of no distinction between a higher and lower nature. The economists Peter Buckley and Mark Casson have argued persuasively that the absence of any conceptualization of a higher nature supports a weakening of the degree of self-control exercised in a society. Consumers and borrowers lacking self-control and self-awareness become easy targets for the selfish manipulation of producers and lenders. Advertising that offers instant credit or that promotes products as instruments of sexual seduction directly undermine the individual consumer's self-control. The systematic use of mass marketing to undermine consumer self-control enables producers to generate the tastes and preferences for goods and services via advertising, and then to supply the purchasing power to buy them by stimulating a growing supply of debt to the consumer. In this context, the following observation of the economist-turned-missionary theologian Leslie Newbegin is particularly incisive. Quote, the economic system is no longer directed to meeting needs. Manufacturing industry does not exist to meet the needs of people. On the contrary, wants are manufactured to meet the needs of industry. Its growth, therefore, far from being a sign of health, may be essentially cancerous, the multiplication of cells as an end in itself. Utilitarian anthropology is problematic in a further respect. Many commentators have observed the systematic assumption made by economic theorists and policymakers that human motivation is characterized by selfishness alone. Clearly, an acknowledgement of selfishness is fully consonant with Christian belief as well as empirical observation. But the exclusion of altruism serves to heighten utilitarianism's individualism in directions contrary to Christian and other personalist conceptions that acknowledge the importance of the social and relational dimension of human nature. This heightened individualism is embedded in a second systemic aspect of capitalism's logic. Having identified the sum total of individual utility with gross domestic product, capitalism is concerned to maximize the outputs of the economic system as a whole. Economic growth is the goal, and growth requires market scale for efficiencies to be realized. Capitalism is a system, and the neoclassical economic theory that underpins it insists that all barriers to the creation of the largest possible market be removed. The language of capitalism describes such barriers as regulations, customs, restrictions to be removed by markets, governments, and societies in order for growth to be realized. These barriers include any impediment to the free movement of goods and services, capital and labor, including familial or communal customs that limit labor mobility in favor of relational proximity, or notions of nationhood that seek to limit foreign ownership of national assets, for example. All such barriers are regarded as limitations to the development of an efficient market. All moral visions of the good that they may embody are relativized in the manner described previously by Charles Taylor. Any qualitative distinction of the good is relativized in favor of increasing the range of choice over which individual expressions of utility can be maximized. In this way, therefore, the systemic logic of capitalism undermines the connections between people and places. In doing so, it also encourages the objectification and use of the environment as nothing more than a resource to serve the consumption needs of humanity. In order for the market to deliver the maximum possible economic growth, the free movement of labour and capital is required in order to ensure the allocation of resources to their most efficient use. Such use will pay slightly higher wages or interest rates in order to attract the right labour or capital. Consequently, wage rates, labour, interest rates and capital must all be completely free to adjust or move in response to changing market conditions and price signals. Government policies to deregulate financial and labour markets to enable high levels of capital mobility to make hiring and firing easy for companies are all guided by this theoretical requirement. Yet the deregulation of labour and financial markets also leads to increased inequality and instability. Increased inequality occurs largely as a result of agglomeration economies in which the returns to capital and skilled labour are concentrated around major metropolitan hubs at the expense of more peripheral areas and unskilled or lesser skilled workers. Increased instability arises directly from increased labour and capital mobility in the form of uncertain job prospects and destabilising speculative capital flows. These processes actively undermine the possibility of rooted community. Both the systemic and individualistic logic of capitalism thus act to reinforce one another in undermining the connections between people and places on the one hand, and people and the past on the other. This separation of people from time and space is what Anthony Giddens describes as distanciation. Accelerated by modern telecommunications technologies, globalization disembeds social relations from local contexts and restructures them across time and space so that symbolic tokens representing tastes and cultural preferences can be rapidly deployed in other contexts where often the original meaning is lost or radically reinterpreted. Capitalist logic is also imperialistic. The vision of individual freedom embodied in capitalism's utility-maximizing anthropology need not stop at the boundaries of the purely economic needs of life. Instead, a constant process of commodification goes on in which ever broader areas of social life become monetized, quantified, so that decisions about marriage, healthcare, voting behavior, education, and so forth are increasingly made as if civic values, learning, caregiving, marital fidelity, or sexuality are just like any other good or service. By disembedding cultural values and then placing them in the service of consumer markets, capitalism gradually reduces all values, all beliefs, all meaning to a matter of taste, preference, and consumption habit. Global capitalism thus contributes to and accelerates the condition of postmodernity and is gradually undermining the nature of place in favour of a borderless world in which everyone belongs equally anywhere, but nobody is at home in community. As a result of the influence of this inner logic of capitalism, globalization is essentially, firstly, a homogenizing force in that it spreads a monocultural version of Western consumerist society around the world based on a fundamentally flawed model of the human person. Secondly, a centralizing force in that it tends to concentrate power in the hands of the owners of capital and, in response to its effects, the purveyors of international political power. And thirdly, a relativizing force in that it reinforces a postmodern confusion by reducing cultural symbols of belief, value, and meaning to matters of taste and preference. Where is this all headed? In evaluating globalization, one reviewer of Joseph Stiglitz's recent book, Globalization and Its Discontents, described globalization as, quote, an enormous, tradition-blind, uncontrolled experiment where no one knows the outcome, end quote. In fact, there is rather more consensus about the likely future course of global capitalism than this implies. I identify four main types of evaluation of the globalization process. And the first is that of the globalization enthusiasts. Globalization theorist Malcolm Waters envisages a single society and culture occupying the entire planet. Culture will be unified only at an extremely abstract level, expressing tolerance for diversity and individual choice. His vision sounds remarkably like a globalized Western liberal democracy, though he sees no need for a central organizing government. Similarly, Jagdish Bhagwati, in his recent book In Defense of Globalization, argues that far from needing humanizing, globalization already has a human face, and its effects need enhancing, not correcting. He proposes modest changes to global governance, designed to give a greater role to non-governmental organizations, to ensure safeguards which allow for occasional downsides, and to better manage the transition to full entry in the global economy by developing countries. Contrary to this enthusiasm and optimism, however, a second group provides a more pessimistic evaluation. Surprisingly, this group is led by the visionary prophets of global capitalism. The economist Robert Heilbronner has noted in his 1993 study, 21st Century Capitalism, how virtually none of the major political and economic theorists of globalization take an optimistic view of its future. Rather, the prophets of capitalism, such as Adam Smith, Alfred Marshall, Joseph Schumpeter, John Maynard Keynes, and Karl Marx, predict that it will be its own undoing. Their visions of capitalism's future have a remarkable degree of coherence, even though the visionaries themselves embrace these visions with wildly differing degrees of enthusiasm. In other words, there's a high degree of unanimity amongst political economists that capitalism is self-destructive, and according to many of these theorists, some form of substantial government intervention or regulation of the economy will be necessary. The basic reason for this is that all the problems identified and foreseen concerning global capitalism, economic instability, inequality of wealth and power, widespread ecological damage, and the growing commodification of life, all arise from within the system itself. The only solution seems to be for the state, governmental institutions, to intervene and manage the problem from outside the system. Unfortunately, it's already a moot point as to whether government is any longer outside of the system. But in any event, we have seen that global capitalism is tending to undermine the power of national governments, and moreover, that many of the major problems facing global capitalism are indeed global in scope. This is why almost all commentators and theorists argue for the creation of ever more powerful structures of world governance and regulation. Heilbronner himself argues that the prospects for 21st century capitalisms will depend, I quote, in the first place, on the success with which they can marshal and apply the forces of government to deal with those of their economies. For Heilbronner, this is likely to involve strong traditions of pragmatic government, public cohesion, national organizations of labor, and a well-developed civil service. Heilbronner would like to see an end to capitalism's, quote, subordination of behavior to economic imperatives, and is an enthusiastic supporter of a participatory economic model. But he is extremely pessimistic about its likely inception. For Heilbronner, this pessimism derives from a version of capitalism's utilitarian anthropology rooted in Freudian psychoanalysis. Capitalism's underlying drives, he argues, quote, stem from the irrational depths of the psyche. We can only hope to moderate them through the development of stronger governmental institutions. Similarly, the sociologist Anthony Giddens advocates a more extensive strengthening of international institutions to regulate the progress of globalization. His proposed reforms include a democratizing of the IMF to take better account of the needs of developing countries, the creation of a global central bank that would enable developing countries to engage in trade and financial transactions, the creation of a global environmental organization to police and enforce environmental treaty obligations, the imposition of a tax on speculative capital flows, and the creation of a global investment treaty overseen by the United Nations that gives power to governments to insist that companies invest in a socially and environmentally responsible manner. Although differences of detail remain, Giddens' approach is similar to that of other moderate critics of globalization, such as Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist of the World Bank, author of the book I mentioned, Globalization and Its Discontents. A range of such writers argue for the strengthening of the power of global institutions in order to improve the functioning of global markets. These thinkers tend to make liberal assumptions about human nature, believing in the ideal of progress and of the power of human reason and rationality to make such progress. The policy recommendations of this group are essentially the same. Governmental institutions need to be strengthened and extended to counter the growing power of capital and the negative effects of unfettered individualism. This approach is in fact fully in line with capitalist economic theory in giving increased scope to government to compensate the losers of the economic gain by taxing or regulating the winners. The anthropologies underlying these recommendations lead to highly ineffective policy solutions. In essence, these materialist conceptions of human nature as fundamentally oriented towards selfish, self-centered behavior first allow an economic system that maximizes monetary output based on harnessing that selfish behavior, but then must develop a sizable countervailing government to counter the negative effects of the process. In a conceptualization where no self-control can operate to constrain behavior at the individual level, and no moral vision of the good is permitted to direct behavior either, all the burden of social change must fall on the state. Quite apart from the huge transactions costs implied by this arrangement and the question of whether some kind of state regulation or compensation for losers is socially or environmentally optimal, this approach should also raise concerns regarding the concentration of political power that it entails. A third group takes this latter concern seriously, but because it shares the same essential anthropological assumptions, offers little in return. The political philosopher John Gray is the best representative of this group. In his book False Dawn, The Delusions of Global Capitalism, Gray laments the process by which bad capitalism drives out good capitalism. Countries cut taxes, run down social welfare programs, remove environmental regulations, all in an attempt to maintain an attractive environment for mobile capital. His ire in False Dawn is targeted at the neoliberal economic establishment who continue to propagate an imperialist capitalism as progress model and thereby drive this process. For Gray, belief in progress serves only to magnify the flaws already present in human nature. Gray's scientific naturalism leads him to critique the very idea of the free conscious self as illusory, and to place little faith in human political institutions. He's especially critical of those intellectual descendants of the Enlightenment who, like him, adhere to a form of materialist scientific naturalism, but who nevertheless cling to the idea of progress or believe that humanity can control its own destiny. In his 2002 book, Straw Dogs, Thoughts on Humans and Other Animals, Gray contends that humanists, quote, like to think they have a rational view of the world. but their core belief in progress is a superstition, further from the truth about the human animal than any of the world's religions, end quote. His solution is typically Epicurean, live and let live. If America would only stop trying to impose its model of capitalism on everyone else, we could all enjoy a quiet life, spend time with our friends, and allow a variety of models to flourish. A fourth and final type of response to global capitalism comes from the communitarian movement. Writers such as Amartya Tsioni and Robert Putnam believe that individualism is eroding the network of social relationships on which civil society depends. They argue for greater social responsibility alongside individual rights, and for active measures to protect and enhance the institutions of civil society. A growing body of research on social capital and the economics of happiness lends support to this movement. UBC economics professor emeritus John Helliwell defines social capital as, quote, the networks, norms, and understandings that facilitate cooperative activities within and among groups of individuals, end quote. These networks, argues Helliwell, reduce transaction costs within an economy and are strongly linked with economic growth, health, longevity, and subjective measures of well-being. Equally, Helliwell's studies on human happiness show that people are happier the more they engage and relate to other people. Central to both happiness and the development of social capital is trust. These arguments provide an implicit critique of globalization. A recent paper by Lars Osborg, titled Pulling Apart, The Growing Gulfs in Canadian Society, charts the increasing inequality and economic insecurity in Canada and links these to aspects of global capitalism on the one hand and the undermining of social capital and trust on the other. Quote, over the past 25 years, a cluster of policies in Canada have aimed at encouraging structural adjustment and increased labour market flexibility. Acceleration of computer-based technological change and greater globalisation of trade would, in any event, have increased labour market risks. But in recent years, there's also been a trend to reducing the social protections of the welfare state. Osborg notes how increased economic insecurity, quote, undermines the personal relationships which are fundamental to individual well-being, end quote. This critique of globalization is more searching and its solutions more effective than those offered by the globalization pessimists, precisely because it offers a more rounded view of human nature in which both selfish and altruistic motivations are recognized and affirmed. Moreover, although the recommendations for change offered by the communitarian movement largely also involve the state as primary actor, these policy proposals are intended not so much to mitigate the negative effects of laissez-faire capitalism, but rather to reshape markets so that fewer negative effects arise in the first place. The role of the state in this approach is therefore qualitatively different to that offered by the globalization optimists and pessimists. One version of communitarianism which goes further than this is that concerned with promoting spiritual capital. In their 2004 book, Spiritual Capital, Wealth We Can Live By, Dana Zahar and Ian Marshall liken capitalism to Ovid's tale of Erisichthon, in which the protagonist greedily cuts down even the sacred oak tree and is then cursed with an insatiable hunger. After consuming all his wealth, he finally ends up eating himself. Capitalism, they argue, fails to help us be who we are. It can't sustain our humanity because it's based on too narrow a definition of what it means to be human. Human fulfillment requires a sense of meaning, and spiritual capital adds to social capital this dimension of our shared meanings, values, and purposes. Unlike the social capital researchers who focus on government measures to restructure society toward a more conducive environment for relationship building, Zahar and Marshall instead develop a theory of individual moral development and leadership which gradually injects the social order with greater levels of, quote, positive psychic energy, end quote. The worldview of this approach, especially, and communitarian approaches in general, can be described as Stoic, in that humanity is encouraged to live in harmony with nature and in fellowship with one another. Zahar and Marshall also incorporate elements of a pantheistic vision of union with the universal consciousness, absent in most communitarian discussion. In similar vein, the worldview of both the globalization enthusiasts and pessimists can be described as Epicurean, in that all share the same basic materialistic scientific naturalism, emphasize the autonomous free will of individual humans, and deny any transcendent source of moral goodness. The communitarian stance is representative of a long-standing strand of thought opposing the instrumentalist society idealized by the Enlightenment. Given that this is a Christian forum, it's appropriate to ask, in the modern-day version of this conflict, where should Christians take their stand? Perhaps some indication is given by the Apostle Paul in his speech to a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers in Athens, recorded in Acts chapter 17. In proclaiming the gospel to these philosophers, Paul quotes approvingly from the poem Phenomena, written by a Stoic philosopher, Aratus of Cilicia, around 275 BC, as a hymn to Jupiter. All need his aid. His power sustains us all. For we his offspring are, and he in love points out to man his labor from above. I'm sure you recognize the quote there from Acts 17. We are his offspring. Although neither Epicurean or Stoic worldviews are Christian, Paul finds much to affirm in the Stoic search for sources of moral goodness in nature. Any genuine search for moral goodness is better than no search at all. There is much to be affirmed in this sense in the communitarian movement's emphasis on the importance of relationships, trust, and meaning, and of the need to so order our society that their expression is nurtured and protected. But the affirmation of moral goods also includes the affirmation of those supported by the materialist worldview. The apostle goes on in his speech to point out the irrationality of worshipping man-made idols, a comment that the Epicureans in his audience no doubt welcomed. Similarly, we can affirm the moral goods of reason and freedom, even while denying that these goods be absolutized. In doing so, we can be confident that the pursuit of these goods will find both fulfillment and unity in the person of Christ. I began with a quote from the father of modern economics, Adam Smith, and I want to conclude with one from one of the newest emerging fields of the discipline, neuroeconomics. A mixture of behavioral psychology, neuroscience, and economics, this field seeks to study human behavior as it actually is, rather than assuming a theoretical model of what it should be like. It uses functional magnetic resonance imaging to study the brain behavior of subjects making economic decisions. Far from finding evidence for the rational utilitarian self, it seems that a particular part of the brain adjudicates the claims of reason and emotion. Quote, "It is as if it is the referee that enforces fairness and overrides narrow self-interest," argues David Lapson, professor of economics at Harvard. George Loewenstein, professor of economics and psychology at Carnegie Mellon University, concludes, "The new science of neuroeconomics is lending support to a very ancient view of human behavior." However, lest we get too excited about these developments, I should warn you that the same techniques have already spawned the new field of, yes, neuromarketing. According to an August issue of Newsweek, researchers in the United States and Europe are already using this approach to test how product brands might be more effectively registered in the brain. The utilitarian logic of capitalism will seek to subvert any good to the ends of the market. In this context, humanizing capital continues to require both a reorientation of our societies and a sustained moral leadership.